Dear God, we thank you that we can be in this place of worship, this place where we can kneel and acknowledge that you are God, you are Lord. God, we've come here to hear a word from you. We've come here to ask for your help, to ask for your mercy, to ask for your guidance, and ask for your strength. God, we thank you. We thank you that you have a word today that can change our hearts and our minds. God, we pray for that, and we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Right now, by the miracle of technology, we're being joined by our 1111 worship service right here at Woodway. Let's welcome 1111. Last summer, the Wall Street Journal wrote an article about a piece of graffiti. Not just any graffiti, but American graffiti. Not just American graffiti, but graffiti found right here in Houston, Texas. What graffiti am I talking about? Well, if you're traveling down I-45 South, you see it every day going into work. There it is. Be someone. Be someone. How many of you are familiar with that piece of graffiti? Raise your hand. A lot of us here are. Now, that's been there for a pretty long time. Matter of fact, according to my kids, that has become a Houston icon, a landmark, that piece of graffiti found on that train bridge that is encouraging us, either sarcastically or perhaps realistically, to be someone. Now, a lot of graffiti simply doesn't last. That will not last. Eventually, someone's going to paint over that, or they're going to pressure wash it away. It won't be here forever. But some graffiti, not a lot, has stood the test of time. Check out this little Italian beauty found in a museum. You see it? That dates back to 200 AD, the second century. It's got some type of Greek words under there. It's got a donkey and a young guy over there with his hands raised up. And if you're wondering what those words mean and what this is all about, hang on to your cowboy hat. We're going to get there in a second. Because to understand really anything, like to understand the translation of those Greek words and understand that image, we need context. We need context. And one of the big problems we have in our society today, we have a lot of problems, is a lack of context. That's one of the big dangers of texting, isn't it? It's one of the big dangers of memes and other ways that we communicate in our modern society is we lack context. Now, I was going to talk about this, and some friend sent this to me randomly, and it's about context. Look at this coffee mug. I just thought this was interesting. It says, "I can do all things through a verse taken out of context." Context is important. Context is critical. If we're going to understand groups of people, if we're going to understand individuals and where they're coming from, we've got to understand context or their story or the story behind the story. Glenn Scrivener says that in our society today, as far as belief is concerned, there are three groups of people. There are more, but there are three groups that Scrivener identifies. He says the first group are called the nones, N-O-N-E-S, the nones. And these are people that when they're filling out a religious survey, when they're asked about God or asked about what religion they are, they'll say none. I have no religious affiliation. Now, part of the nones, if you look at the Pew Research, will show that some of them are agnostic, some of them are atheists, some of them may believe in God or a higher power, but they're not religiously affiliated. They're nones. Also, some, he says, are called duns, D-O-N-E-S. Duns are people that perhaps you went to an evangelical private school, or maybe you went to a Catholic school, or maybe you went to a retreat or something when you were younger, and you said, you know, I've tried Christianity. It doesn't work. I'm done. I'm moving on to something else. So you have a group called the duns. Then you have a group of people called the ones, W-O-N-S, the ones. And the ones are the people that have come into a relationship with God in Jesus Christ, and they're seeking to live out his teachings in their everyday life, in their families, at work, and in every aspect of their life. But to understand nones and dones and ones, yet again, we need to understand their context, their story behind the story. Take the example of a public intellectual I've been following for quite a long time named Ayaan Hirsi Ali. There's a picture of Ayaan right there. Interesting story. For many years, she's been a part of what's been known as the New Atheist Movement. Very good friends and colleagues with the late Christopher Hitchens, with Sam Harris, and with Richard Dawkins. So she kind of falls in between, say, a dun and maybe a nun. But you ask the question, how did someone like Ayaan get to a place where she says, I'm done, or I don't believe there is a God? Well, if you know her story, she was born and raised in Somalia. She was practicing Islam, and then there a certain radicalization took place within her community. She was mutilated as a young girl. They tried to arrange a marriage for her. She fled to Europe. She found herself in Holland. She made a film with a guy by the name of Theo van Gogh. This film was about women's rights in Islamic countries. Theo van Gogh was killed and murdered in the streets of Amsterdam. They found a knife stabbed through his heart, and on that night there was a note, and the note said, Ayaan, you're next. So she fled to Britain, eventually found her way to the United States, and again became affiliated with the New Atheist Movement. Because she felt, obviously, right, if you know her story, that all religions are equally bad. All religions are equally dark. So there's always a story behind the story. There's always a context, whether we're talking about a sign, a piece of graffiti, whether we're talking about people groups, whether we're talking about individuals. There's a story behind the story, and it's critical that we understand that. So today I thought we would do something. This is spring break. We would take a spring break, if you would, from the parables, briefly from the parables, and we would get ready for Easter. And I thought it would be helpful to all of us here, no matter where you are, whether if you're a one or a none or a done, if you're watching this one or a none, someone passes to you, to understand the deep and profound context that leads up to the Easter story. To understand the importance and the power of the message and how this message has impacted the world and has also impacted and built this Western world that we're so familiar with. So to do that, I have a handout here. So everybody get a handout here, and you should have gotten a pen too. A pen is a writing instrument that has ink in it. No one uses them anymore. I still do sometimes. I will use a pen, not a pencil, but a pen. So you can fill out the blanks with me, and then on back are some of the scriptures that we're going to cover here today. So if you want to fill this out with me, you can do that, or fill along. It'll help you follow this message. Let's look at that first verse. We can flip over and look at the verse we're going to look at. 1 Corinthians chapter number 1, verse 18. Paul is writing to a church in Corinth. He founded it in around 51 A.D. He's writing this letter in around 55 A.D., The Corinthians church is much like the city of Houston. It's an international cosmopolitan city. It was a port city. It was a great church, but it was a church with many, many problems. And he is writing to them in this one verse, verse 18. He says, listen, the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. So if you're filling that out, the first blank there is, why was the message called foolishness? Why was it called foolishness? Well, to understand why Paul and Peter and John, as they went out into the Greco-Roman world and gave this message, why was it called foolishness? Why was it called foolishness? We have to understand a little bit about the context of the Roman world that was dominant and pervasive in the lives of these first followers of Christ. First of all, we need to understand this. The Romans were the apex predators of the ancient world. They believed that might made right. They believed in survival of the fittest before Darwin ever dreamed that term up. They believed that power determines everything in your life, that your identity, that your social class was defined by where you were born and how you were born. There was a rigid hierarchy socially and a hierarchy of being within the Roman Empire. There were people at the top, there were people in the middle, and there were people at the bottom, and there were people at the bottom of the bottom. In the Roman Empire, you had millions and millions of slaves. Red and yellow, black and white, they were slaves in Caesar's sight. 30% of the population were slaves from all over the world as the Roman army conquered and subjugated so many millions of people. So slavery was massive. The Romans, though we see them so many times in the movies and stuff that have been as sophisticated, erudite people, well, they were on some incidences, but on most of the time, they were very brutal. They ruled in a cruel and callous world. They practiced something for centuries in the Roman Empire called exposure. And exposure was when a Roman family would have a child that they did not want. And they would take the child or they'd take the infant and they would throw it down a well. They would drown the infant in a river. If, you know, if someone deemed the boy or the girl pretty enough, they would sell them to the local brothel, the prostitution ring, which was run by the state and sanctioned by the state. They would throw them in a garbage dump. When a Roman family would have a child, the husband had absolute power. If it was a girl, he may say, discard it in the street or take it down to a brothel. If it was a boy, let's raise him up. That was the hierarchy. There was no Roman dream of moving up the ladder. Everybody was born into this rigid hierarchy of being. No one would have painted, either sarcastically or realistically, a graffiti that said, be someone, unless you were a Roman citizen. Now, if you're wondering, in a society of what, 35% of your population are slaves, how do you keep people in order? How do you keep people from rebelling? Well, the Romans ruled by fear, by intimidation, and by crucifixion. A Roman citizen could not be crucified. It was so ghastly, so painful, so gross, so utterly shameful and degrading and dehumanizing. A Roman citizen could not, would not, shall not be crucified. Paul was not crucified. He was beheaded under Nero, but not crucified. Peter, because he was not a Roman citizen, was crucified. Hundreds of thousands of people were crucified, primarily slaves, rebels, and criminals were crucified by the Romans. And it was a painful death, as we've heard many times within the context of the church. It lasted hours, sometimes it lasted days. And that was simply one aspect of it, the brutality. The most detestable part for people living in that very rigid culture was the shame factor. You were hung, you were crucified naked. It was a public proclamation that you are the lowest of the low, you are the scum of the earth, you are a servant or a slave, or you've sunk so low that you have been crucified. One of the senators within the Roman government was murdered by one of his slaves. The Senate, it'd be like our Congress doing this, the Senate voted that this senator's 400 slaves that he had, all of them, men, women, and children, were to be crucified. So they cobbled together 400 crosses and crucified 400 men, women, and children. Crucifixion was more than just a physical, agonizing, torturous death. It was more than showing that you have hit the very rock bottom of existence. But it was a billboard of power, where Rome was saying, if any of you non-Romans blink or twitch, this is what will happen to you. So, back to the Italian graffiti. Let's go back to that picture. Tell you what it is, tell you what it says, now that we have a little bit of context. So that picture, which you can still see today in an Italian museum, is a picture of a donkey on a cross and a young boy, where it looks like worshiping the donkey on the cross. And then the words, if you translated the words into English, it says, Alexamenos worships his God. So this piece of graffiti that survived the test of time is the first depiction we actually have in writing or art of the crucifixion. And it's kind of an early second century meme, if you would. It's mocking. It's saying this person, Alexamenos, is probably a Christian, a young guy, is worshiping a donkey who he thinks is God. So this graffiti is saying to us within the context, the person on a cross is not the Son of God. He's not God. He's a donkey. He's been crucified. And you, Alexamenos, are pretty much of a donkey or an asinine person for engaging in such an act, for engaging in foolishness, crazy, insanity. You're taking the message of a crucifixion? You're taking a hangman's noose? An electric chair? That's going to be the center of your religion and the Greco-Roman world? So how astonishing it was to Greco-Roman citizens when they heard this message delivered by Paul, delivered by John and Peter and Thomas and others, that a particular person, a particular victim in an obscure small town region of the Roman Empire was crucified. Hundreds of thousands of people were crucified. That was no big deal. But this particular one that was crucified was actually God in the flesh. The message that Paul proclaimed, that the early believers proclaimed, was counter-cultural, counter-intuitive. Yet it was a message that explained why we're here, what went wrong, and where we're going. And it's this message that grew from 11 kind of flaky, doubtful, cowardly people at one time to 2.5 billion people today that are alive, that are followers of this man called Jesus Christ. If you're keeping your scorecard here, it's the message that changed the world. The message starts off by saying, before there was beginning, God existed. Before there was a beginning, Logos, reason, existed, John chapter 1. And this logos, reason, this triune being spoke and created the universe, the galaxies and earth. He created man and woman in his very image. He put them in this idyllic place. And then we know, as we read the story in Genesis 3, that the man and the woman broke away from the knowledge of God. Destruction, evil, suffering, sin entered into the world. God came in and he broke through. He broke through his promises, through his covenants, and then he broke through ultimately through sending his son, Jesus Christ, to live a perfect life, to die, to rise again. And then we know that he will come back and he will re-beautify, he will recreate this world that we live. That is the story, that is the meta-narrative that is for everyone and every place. That's the message of the cross. And the message of the cross is the power of God. All humans are of equal value. That's a Christian belief and assumption. All people are made in the image of God. That is a Christian assumption and belief. All have sinned and all are separated. No matter where you are in the supposed social hierarchy in the Greco-Roman world, that's Christian. The Son died for everyone equally, up and out, the down and out. It's the message. The message of the cross is the power of God. And the message has ongoing, reverberating, rippling effects. The message, we know, changed the world, but the message also created what we know as Western civilization. Secular historian Tom Holland wrote his magnum opus called Dominion. It was followed by another book by Glenn Scrivener called The Air We Breathe. And in these two works, these authors argue that the beliefs that we so deeply cherish, freedom, equality, human rights, all grow from Christian soil alone. They were exemplified by the teachings and sacrifice of Christ and popularized by the letters of a former hater named Paul. This is the foundational story. This is the core message that undergirds the entire Western world. Christ created the culture we call the West. Christ provides the foundation for our culture, our values, our hopes, and our dreams. The subversive origins that exploded onto the scene in around 33 AD has an enduring influence and impact on the world in which we live in today, whether we recognize that or not. Whether we're a one or a done or a none, it doesn't matter. Christianity, as Scrivener argues, is the air we breathe. It's the air we breathe. Our enemies, those that have tried to abolish Christianity, like Nietzsche and Karl Marx, understand that much better than the contemporary so-called enemies of Christ and enemies of the church today. They understood the implications of the death of God and the value vacuum that that would leave in the Western world. But the message is cosmic, it's profound, and the message is personal. It's always been that way as it's grown and been passed down from generation to generation to generation. And when I say the message undergirds our belief, what do I mean by that? Well, first of all, the message we see gives us the ultimate basis for truth, beauty, and goodness. Truth, beauty, and goodness. The absolutes, the ideal that Plato longed for. The message of the cross, the message of Christ, gives us those foundations, thereby giving us meaning in a seemingly meaningless world. The message also provides the necessary superstructure that allows us to make sense of science, reason, and morality, thereby grounding our knowledge and our ethics in a reality outside of ourselves. Also, pragmatically, the message fulfills our psychological, sociological, and theological needs, thereby solving the problem of human existence. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? Acts 17, verse 28 says this, "For it's in him we live and move and have our being." As some of your poets have written, we are his offspring. So from 33 AD, if you would, to 313 AD, those first 300 years of the church, as Christians were trying not to be put in prison, as they were trying not to be martyred and hung on more crosses, as they were trying not to be used as torches and lamps at Nero's party, they were also teasing out and living out the implications of Christ crucified. They were living out the ethics and the morals that we assume today in our society and the world that we live in. So the message says, what does it say? The message says all humans are of equal value. They're of equal value. I know we have some surgeons here, and I know we're in the worship center today, and those that are watching, you're going to operate and cut some people open tomorrow. Many of you have been doing that for decades now. I'll bet you this. Out of all the people that you've cut open, those you're going to cut open tomorrow, I guarantee you, as you've been cutting open these bodies, you have not found equality in there, have you? When you've been cutting open people, do you find human rights in there? No, these things now that we think are self-evident, as Jefferson wrote, are not self-evident. They're God-evident. They're Christian-evident. That's where we're drawing it from. Well, our brains and minds figured it out. No, they didn't. Read it. Read the history. See how the development of human rights happened. Human rights and equality, compassion for the weak and the oppressed, derive from the Christian message that all humans are of equal value, made in the image of God, all of sin. The Son died for everyone equally. Now, let me be clear. Have Christians lived this out well or swimmingly over the last 2,000 years? Absolutely not. There's been some horrific things done in the name of Christianity, in the name of Christ. But even to argue against these horrific things done by other Christians, we have to use Christian assumptions and moralities and standards. It's like a four-year-old who has to climb up on his father's lap to slap him in the face. The message says what else? It says that we must show compassion for the weak and the wounded. The weak and the wounded. The great Antonine Plague in 165 AD and the Cyprian Plague in 252 AD. The Antonine Plague took 8 million people died in that plague, 25% of the Roman population. The Cyprian Plague, we don't know the numbers. We know at the height of that plague, which lasted 2 decades, 20 years, 5,000 people a day were dying in Rome. The people, the citizens, were fleeing to the countryside, fleeing. They would find out a friend or a family member or a child that had it, and they would cast them out into the streets. And as all the people were fleeing into the countryside, throwing these people out in the streets, and hundreds of thousands of people were dying and dying and dying, it were the Christians that ran into the fire. Just like on 9/11, it was the Christians that ran into the fire to take care of the people that were dying on the streets, to comfort them and to help them, to try to heal them. And many of them died in doing so of the plague. Others, though, didn't die, and they helped people live. That's where the whole concept of public hospitals came from. The word hospital comes from the word hospitality, to show hospitality to a guest. That's what a hospital is. The whole profession of nursing came out of this time period. Christian roots, Christian beginnings. Exposure to babies, when they would throw, the Roman citizens would throw babies out into the street, or they would throw them into a garbage dump. It was the Christians that went looking for them. It was the Christians that went into the brothels and would see the boys and the girls that were prostitutes and buy them back. It was Christians that sought to buy out slaves in these early three centuries to bring them and to raise them in their homes. It was Christians that were living out and showing what compassion was like in a compassionless society. The message says, the strong suffer for the weak. That's what the cross says, doesn't it? The message says the strong suffer for the weak. He who is rich became poor for our sake. As Holland said, the powerless triumphed over the powerful. The weak triumphed over the strong. The fittest sacrifice for the weakest. It's the message of the cross. And the message of the cross is the power of God. And this message is it's historical and experiential. It always has been. I don't want you to leave here thinking, well, Christianity is some philosophical worldview, though it is. Christianity is some, some intellectual assent to a bunch of propositional truth. It's that, but not really. Christianity has always been an experience-driven religion or relationship with God. So God calls us out. If you say, hey, I'm in that one, W-O-N category, I'm one, it calls us to present a compelling and unifying story and that we must live out this story day by day, moment by moment. Showing compassion to those who are hurting, who are weak, those who are on the margins, as we're following the example of Christ. Philippians 2, one of the earliest passages and creeds that we have, says that Christ emptied himself, took on the nature of a servant, served other people, touched lepers, hurt people, was around and touched and healed hurting people, marginalized people. Christ calls us to do that today. And then one more thing about the message. The message calls for a response. Whether it was a bunch of smelly fishermen like Peter and John or sophisticated intellectuals like Paul and Irenaeus, when they took this message out into the streets, when they took this message into the synagogues, when they took this message from the towns and cities and the boats, as they traveled around the world, they always called for a response. So I want to challenge you. If perhaps you're here, or maybe you're watching or listening and you say, man, I'm a nun, I'm not affiliated. Or maybe you say, man, I'm done. I tried Christianity, probably in my opinion, a reductionistic form of Christianity. I wanna encourage you to explore, if you would, the deep implications of the message of Christ, the message of the cross. Explore that. If you want to, again, if you're following along here, you can go to my website, benyoung.org. Go there. There's three books I'd recommend if you really want to get after it. Also, there are answers to these fill in the blanks if you missed that. So go there. There's some resources there. But more importantly, just have a mindset where I say, God, I want to be open to you. I want to be open to this possibility that you are real. I want to be open to this opportunity that this cross and this message of the cross that is the power of God can still be powerful in my life today. Explore it. If you're a one, you say, man, I'm in. You're preaching to the choir. Well, sometimes the choir needs preaching too. Not our choir, but others. Look at 1 Corinthians 16 says, be on your guard, stand firm in the faith, be courageous, be strong, do everything in agape. Love. Love. doubt gets a bad rap in the church. But sometimes doubt is good. Did you know that? Let's go back. Remember Ayaan Hirsi Ali? You remember her? Yeah. Public intellectual, author. A couple of years ago, she began to doubt her atheism. She began to doubt it. She said she began to doubt it because it couldn't answer one question for her, and that is the question, why am I here? What is my purpose? What is the meaning of life? So she went into a time of what she calls personal despair and crisis. She said she was filled with fear and anxiety and depression. So she went to a therapist. She said, I went to the best therapist that money can buy, and they tried to get at the root problem of why I was feeling this way. But she said there was still a spiritual hole in my life. So she said, I tried to self-medicate. She said, I drank enough alcohol to sterilize an entire hospital. I continued to read books on psychology, she said, to figure it out. And she said, finally, one of her therapists said, Ayaan, I think you're spiritually bankrupt. And she said, I had given up hope. She said, I was in a place of darkness, but I thought, why not? Why not open myself up to this possibility? And she told this therapist, she said, listen, the God that I grew up with was a horror show who hated women, who hated me, who was brutal and cruel. And the therapist said, I want you to do something. Ayaan, I want you to write out a description of what you think would be a good God or higher power. Write that out. And so Ayaan said, I began to do that. And she said, as I finished writing, I realized that I had just written a description of Jesus Christ. Yeah. So, she said, I don't want to start yet another religion. So me and her fellow atheist husband, Niall Ferguson, have started attending church. She said, that void in my life is gone. And I feel like I'm going somewhere. The message of the cross is the power of God.